Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with Nick.
Hi, everyone. Today we've got Brian Clayton in with us today. And he's going to give us a little rundown in terms of his background and his business or multiple businesses. And we're going to be talking about a couple of interesting topics: how to get to your first 1,000 customers, how to keep motivated as you grow to those numbers, and then the impact of social media in a legacy business, a business that's been going for 10 years, and how that's adapted or changed your personal brand and the way you go about business. So, Brian, I'm just going to hand it over to you in terms of giving us the elevator pitch in terms of who are you and where are you at the moment.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me on your podcast, Nick. I'm Brian Clayton. I'm CEO of Green Pal out of Nashville, Tennessee. And Green Pal is a marketplace and mobile app that works like Instacart or DoorDash or Uber, but for lawn mowing services. So if you're a homeowner and you're needing to get someone to come mow your yard, rather than calling all over the place, like on Craigslist or Facebook or something, you just download GreenPal, pop your address in, and somebody comes out and takes care of it for you. GreenPal is a 10-year overnight success. My two co-founders and I have been at this for over a decade. And now we have around 300,000 people using the app to get lawn mowing services done. So gotten here just little by little, year over year, just with slow, steady, compounding growth. We haven't raised any outside money or anything like that, so just have funded the business off of its own revenues. And it's a lot of fun. Running a marketplace like this is a lot of fun. It's kind of cool helping small business owners grow their lawn care company on our technology and helping consumers get this chore done.
So I take it there's a lot of grass in Tennessee.
A lot of grass in Tennessee, a lot of grass in the U.S. that people are fortunately too busy or too lazy to mow themselves. And so we're there to provide a solution for that. And it never stops growing. That's the good part.
Now, 300,000 customers. I mean, that is a lot. And so that's 300,000 customers. Now, you've got both customers and you've got the lawn care providers as well. So how many lawn care providers sort of on average do you have on your platform?
Yeah, it's a good point. We're a multi-sided marketplace, so we connect buyers and sellers. And so we kind of have two customers. We have consumers that need help hiring a pro, and then the other customer we have is the actual pro that does the work. And we have to solve problems for them as well. We have a value proposition for them. And there's around 35,000 of those guys and gals that use the platform to make a living, that mow lawns on the platform, and many of them, that's all they do to make their livelihood. And so it's a lot of fun being a part of that.
So 35,000 providers. So basically you have two sets of customers, which means you've got to do double the work.
That's
because,
right.
For other companies that are just looking for customers, that's one angle. But you've got both. You've got the supply side and the delivery side. So that must add its own challenges as well.
Absolutely. It's very much a chicken and egg problem that you're always facing. You're always trying to solve problems for the consumer side and then try to solve problems for the demand side, and kind of ping ponging back and forth and striking that balance between the two in terms of a happy medium of setting the rules of the platform for them to conduct commerce on the platform. And so sometimes you err on the side of one at the expense of the other. And, you know, you've seen this with Uber at times. They had to try to figure out rules around surge pricing and things like that. And so there's no like playbook for this. You just kind of have to go through it trial and error, one experiment to the next. And we think we've struck a pretty good balance now. We have 3,000 or 4,000 transactions happening a day on the platform. And while it's not perfect, it is a good kind of rules of the game that's fair for consumers and fair for service providers.
So you mentioned 300,000 customers. They're obviously not all having their lawns mown at the same time. But I think for our listeners and viewers in other countries which are a bit smaller, I mean, Norway's got 5 million people. That's where I live right now. And I don't think there are 300,000 yards to be mown in the whole of Norway. So, I mean, I think the scale in the US is something else compared to what we used to. You are just in Tennessee at the moment, or is this moving into other states? I mean, I think there's tax and there's obviously legal requirements that are slightly different in other territories. What is the game plan for you to take that to a million users?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we started off just in Tennessee, and that's an important distinction, because when you're building a multi-sided marketplace like this, you're inventing a new product and you're bringing a new product to the market, it can be beneficial to fail on a small stage, to test it in one little area until you get it right. And so we spent 3 or 4 years just in Nashville, Tennessee, figuring out how do we, like I mentioned earlier, strike that balance between buyers and sellers. How do we build a product that's delightful to use on both sides of the transaction and go through those kind of cycles of failure, really, on a small stage until we figured out and then move out to other cities. And so that's kind of what we did. We spent almost 4 years just in Nashville. And then we laid out a expansion plan, like a little playbook to roll out in the other cities, and took us 6 months to figure out how to put it in a second metropolitan area, Atlanta, Georgia. And then it took another year to figure out how to get it in a third. And then once we started doing that, we developed a little repeatable process, a recipe almost, that we could follow in every city and every town. And now we're nationwide in the United States. We're in every major city in the country. And in that early kind of nail it, then scale it strategy, I think, is kind of what got us here. There was a lot of Uber for, you know, Uber for home cleaning, Uber for home painting, Uber for laundry service, types of services that came out of the ground in 2013, 14, and most of them failed because they tried to step on the gas too soon. They tried to pour venture capital on top of a process that wasn't working. So that was critical for us, was nail it, then scale it.
So you spoke about you're a 10-year overnight success. And I think that's, if one looks at most successful companies around the world, Tesla blew up from nowhere, again, 10 years to get to the stage where it is. Google, Facebook maybe was a little bit quicker, but most companies have this sort of 10-year learning curve to get to a position where they are ready to scale, expand, and really offer value to the market. It goes then into our next discussion, which is on motivation. How did you keep yourself going in those first few years when you didn't have 300,000 customers? It was a slog, not everything worked. What were some of the processes maybe that you used to keep you and your team motivated to keep going and not close down like those other competitors with perhaps more money behind them? What gave you your edge, Brian?
It was a couple things. I think managing your own psychology as a founder is more than half of the battle. And I heard a quote one time that made sense to me, that success is expectations minus results. And so I think if you can manage your expectations around what that first year is going to look like, what the second year is going to look like, what the third year is going to look like, and know it is not going to be like the movie, The Social Network, where you just get behind a laptop and code up some stuff and you have a million users in 6 months. That is not how it goes. There are no overnight successes. The first year, 2, 3 years are going to be a slog. But the way we kind of got through it is we set little small goals and then poured everything we had into getting that goal knocked down. And so our first goal was 100 customers. We just wanted 100 people to use it in 1 week. And we wanted to do that every single week. So 100 transactions each week. And it took us 2 years to get there. And just through meeting with people, figuring out where we were screwing up, figuring out where we were letting them down. Why wouldn't they tell their friends and family about it? Why didn't they keep using it? Where would they like to see it improved? And just going through those iterations, putting in those reps to get 100 customers, gave us a little bit of a foundation to then get to 1,000. And when we got to 100, we celebrated that like it was a million. It was because it proved to ourselves that we had something. And if we could just add a couple zeros on the end, we would eventually have a business. So what worked for us was setting little small goals, pretending and almost like celebrating them like they were huge, huge wins, because in a way they were. And managing our psychology around that is what got us through the first 2 or 3 years, which were tough. Looking back, they were not fun, but I'm glad we stuck it out.
Yeah. And I think celebrating those small wins is important. And one of the things I talk with clients and my students is KPIs and goals are super important. And how you set those goals is also important. And
that's right.
Yeah. So maybe talk to me about, and you've spoken about, getting 100 users on your platform a week was a KPI. How did you start scaling it from there? When did you realize, wait a minute, we can actually get to 1,000, 10,000? And maybe talk to me about the scaling from zero customers to, your 100 customers to 1,000. And then, how 1,000 customers is a lot. How do you, paying customers, taking that to the next level must have been very exciting. So maybe just that first 1,000 customers, how did you get there?
Yeah, it was exciting. And because you realize that, okay, I've got 100 people using it. It's very hand-to-hand combat right now. It's very manual in a way. It still was spreadsheets. It was still phone calls. It was text messages. It was still a lot of hand cranking to make the trains run on time, so to speak. But you start to look at the things that you're hand cranking, like almost like Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, like the things that you're doing in a very manual way. You then build in the processes and the technology to automate them. And if you don't go through that kind of ground and pound, hand to hand combat type of process to get to 100, you then don't know what you have to automate later. And so to get from 100 to 1,000 was dissecting all of the things that could be automated away, all of the things that could have a workflow built for them, that could have a back-end process to handle and make run smoother, is how we got from 100 to 1,000. And particularly around user acquisition, figuring out how do you get people to discover your product when they need it. And for us, when your grass is 3 feet tall, What do you do to solve that problem? And outside of asking friends and family for recommendations, you go to Google and you type lawn mowing service nearby me. And so unpacking how do we make GreenPal appear in those searches, and what goes into that, and developing a process around that, and how do we use the platform to give Google what it wants to show us in that search engine results page when people are looking for that, was a big part of going from 100 to 1,000. Took us about 2 years to figure out, but as you start to scale and bolt on users, you're looking for ways to automate things. You're looking for ways to streamline things that you were doing by hand, and you move from this in the business to on the business type of mentality. The first 100 customers is very much in the business, hand cranking it. 100 to 1,000 is on the business. How do I build the systems? How do I build the processes that I learned in the first 100?
It sounds very Unilever-like, because for the reason Unilever's been successful around the world is because everyone who works in the business has basically been there from the ground up. You've seen those stories of guys selling Pantene, which is the hair care product, on camels into villages in India. So
nice.
they know who the customer is. They understand the difficulty of getting the product into new areas, and they really understand their customer. So that first 100, getting to know what the challenges are, being on the ground, I think super important. When it comes to data and processes and automation, did you think when you were growing up that automation was going to be your best friend, and that data was going to be your best friend, and that you were going to be become proficient and expert at that? Was that your goal, to be a data specialist?
Oh no, I hate spreadsheets. I hate data. I'm more of a gut feeling, shoot from the hip kind of guy. But when you've been proven wrong time and time and time again, you learn a hard lesson. It's, either we're going to let the data speak, or we're just going to go with my opinion. And if we go with my opinion, one of two things is going to happen. Either we're going to be right and it's going to be a success, or we're going to be lucky and be lucky, or it's going to fail. And it's, so either you're going to be lucky and it's, or you're going to fail. And like, luck is not a strategy. And so I had to learn this lesson the hard way, over and over and over again. And I think for me, you know, it's one of the fun things about running a tech business, because you can rely on quantitative data. Whereas if you're running a traditional brick and mortar style of business, you kind of always operate in the qualitative data realm. You don't have enough volume of data to look at. And so that's one of the things I had to kind of teach myself when I transitioned from a blue collar entrepreneur to a tech entrepreneur, was to let the data speak when we had enough of it. In the early days, you don't have enough of it. It's still very much intuition, gut calls, talking to customers, talking to users, usability studies, things like that. But after we started getting 1,000, 10,000, and 100,000 people, we could then look at the data and try to figure out, okay, why is it that, you know, when people sign up and they get 5 quotes for lawn mowing services, why is it only 40% hire somebody? Why is it 60% never hire anybody? And let's look at that. Let's try to take that 60% and improve it to 50%. So how can we move that 10%? And let's do some experiments and with the presentation or the speed or the pricing or the order of the quotes, and all of these different things that you can tinker with that you can do when you're in a technology business like this, versus, you know, if you're running a traditional lawn mowing business, you're just trying to operate the mowers and make sure that they're fixed and making sure that they're running properly. You're not worried about those types of things. And so that's one of the things that can be fun, but it can also be daunting, because like, where do you start? And if you don't have that instrumented correctly, the data can actually steer you in the wrong direction, which it was quite sad when A/B testing first started getting popular about 10 years ago. There was all of these founders and entrepreneurs like just doing nothing but A/B testing, and it was guiding them actually in the wrong direction. So you have to be careful about this stuff. But as time goes on, you know, if you're going to get to 100,000 plus users, you're going to have to rely on data to inform your strategy, to inform your decision making. If not, one of two things is going to happen: either you're going to fail or you're going to get lucky. And luck is not a strategy.
So I love that you've said you've moved into being a tech business, not, you know, it's not a grass cutting business. I mean, that's the solution you're providing, but you are in fact a tech business, and that's quite an amazing transition for a business. When it comes to data, and I've worked in analytics and data science for quite a while now. You mentioned that you focus a lot on the data. Sometimes data can also steer you in the wrong direction, as you've mentioned. How do you strike that balance between what the data is telling you? Because right now, in the early days, data was quite widespread, wasn't very accurate. Now, and only a few people, few big companies could afford to have great data. Now you've got great data. I'm sure you've got clean spreadsheets. You've got clean databases. Imagining everyone has the same quality data now, what is your special source to take that data and make it useful, that your creative use of data? Because you cannot just be using data to make your decisions. Obviously, it makes life easier and your business more efficient. But what are you doing with that data that other people aren't?
Yeah, it's a good question, because especially with a marketplace like ours, because building a marketplace, it's very different than building like a SaaS business or an e-commerce business, where it's very linear and you're just trying to improve like steps along the funnel and using data to improve that. That's hard, but a marketplace is actually an order of magnitude harder, because you're not really like moving from one end to the other. You're more like a farmer almost, and you're making a change over here and you're cultivating over here, and then you're gonna see what happens. And it's like you tinker on the supply side. Okay, what happens 6 months from now with all of those users that experience that? And so the data might tell you, hey, this is going to lead to more transactions, but actually it's pissing off vendors, and then that leads to negative network effects, where vendors begin to abandon the platform. And then when they abandon the platform, homeowners don't get quotes. And when they don't get quotes, they don't come and use the platform. And when they don't come and use the platform, then less vendors want to use it, and so on. Then you get this negative loop. And so you want to look for ways to speed that flywheel up. And a lot of times, I'll just give you an example in our, you know, that we dealt with maybe year four or five, consumers wanted to use the platform to just hire one lawn mowing service at a time. And that was one of their major objections when we would get qualitative surveys and also look at the quantitative data that when we made them fall into a cadence of service, they would bounce. And so the data would tell us, look, if you opened up this ability for them to order one service every time they wanted it, then you would double your users. That's what the data was telling us. Well, the reality is service providers hate that. If they come and mow your yard one time, they lost money. They don't make any margin until they have you as a customer 4, 5, 6, 10 visits. They don't make any money until the fourth or fifth visit. And consumers don't know that. And so we tried this experiment where you could order it a la carte, and the net result was there was negative network effects. Vendors began to abandon the platform because of that. And so that was an example that data was telling us that, hey, if you do this, it's going to make more consumers happy. Therefore, you're going to have more throughput of users. You're going to grow. But the reality is it pissed off the supply side. They abandoned the platform, and then there was no product to sell. And so you kind of have to be data informed. That's kind of a cliche, but like you have to also have this conviction, this vision for how you see the world, and that doesn't change. But the data helps you make the decisions to guide your path on how to get there, on how to climb the mountain. But it can't just be the only thing you use to make your decision making on, because it can steer you in the wrong. In the wrong direction, as it did us there. We implemented that, even though I knew the industry very well. We implemented that, and it was a total failure.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to motivation. You've said you're on 300,000 customers, which is a great milestone. How do you scale that? What you don't have to give away industry secrets, but what is the number that you're looking at in your head, and what are sort of your sort of step shifts in either management or strategy in order to get that up? Is there a cap on the market as well?
Yeah, I don't think there's a cap. We're 300,000 people and 30 million a year in sales, and it's a $99 billion industry in the United States. So it's like we're a drop in the bucket. And so for us, there's so much white space for how much of the actual activities happening that we're not facilitating, that we can keep going in this for another decade. So that's a good thing. And to your point, we want to get to 1 million users, because my gut tells me that puts us in a different conversation. Maybe that puts us in the same kind of league as Instacart or an Uber or a DoorDash. These are US names that operate, you know, peer-to-peer marketplaces, kind of like what we do. And so that's where we're going, and we'll get there. It's just a matter of how long, and how do you do it? I think it's every business goes through three phases. There's the startup, which is just trying to get an idea out the door that people want to use, and then there's the grow up. You know, we've got a little bit of a thing working here, and then there's the scale up. So the startup, the grow up, and the scale up. And I think somewhere right now we're at the tail end of the grow up phase, and we're just now entering the scale up phase. And in the scale up phase, it's more about, okay, looking at this org chart of all of these roles and goals that we have. You know, my name may still be on 10 roles. You know, I'm still kind of head of growth. I'm still kind of in my part-time head of product. I'm the CEO. I'm also the COO. And so I'm kind of, you know, I got my name on like 4 or 5 different roles. How do we put in really experienced operators in these roles? You know, a head of product that knows product-led growth, that's done it before, that's gone from 1 million to 10 million users. And how do we put in a head of growth that's managed a multifaceted growth team who can just focus just on that? You know, that's getting from the grow up to the scale up phase. And we're kind of just now entering that. And when you're venture backed, when you have a bunch of venture capital, you can move through these phases quicker. If it doesn't work, it crashes and burns. But when you're self-funded like we are, we very much have to make these bets much more carefully because we have much fewer swings at the plate. So that's where we're at. I've never done that before. I've done the grow up phase twice now, but we may find that I suck at it. And if I suck at it, we'll get a professional CEO to manage that and shepherd that. But I'm going to try it. We'll see.
Well, I guess that's one of the tough things about startups is sometimes the folks who start it aren't necessarily the right guys to take it forward.
Very true.
And I've seen that in my own business as well, when I've had to hire in those senior positions that you mentioned. And those are critical make or break appointments, because
exactly.
You are now, these guys have got your baby in their hands. And if they don't have the same love, they're not as motivated, not as bought into the business, they could create huge issues for the business and even take it down. So the HR side, I found, as the business grows, takes more and more time, takes more and more effort, and is a more critical part of the business, even though it's a service, it is a service function versus a new business generation function. And that's always frustrating for, I suppose, folks like us who are very driven for sales and new business and
right.
driving the business forward. Now you've got to slow down, almost get the structures right for growth. And it's a very complicated phase to go through.
It really is. And I think every business's journey reaches the choke point of the founder's capabilities and the founder's evolution and the founder's growth alongside it. If the founder's not willing to earmark time for recruiting and earmark time to do these things, then the business is going to reach that choke point. And I think if you're doing a business journey right, you as the founder should evolve into a whole new person every year or two. That's kind of the way it's been for me, 10 years of GreenPal. I'm a whole new person every couple of years. And that's one of the fun things about it, is like the business is requiring you to grow and evolve and step up and learn these skills and do these different things. The moment you quit doing that is the moment you'll also see the business plateau usually.
So talking about that, and I think that the discussion about personal growth and leadership growth is so important. How are you keeping yourself motivated on a day-to-day basis? Because sure, your business is turning over good money. You've got you've obviously got good guys working with you. What is keeping you motivated to get to that million? Is it cash money, or is it there's a bigger purpose for you in terms of this business or generally?
Yeah, it's as you work through the levels of the game, the first two or three levels might be motivated by making money. It certainly has been for me now twice. I built and sold a company and then started GreenPal. And so there is that phase of it. And then once you kind of get just enough cash, you realize that there's got to be something more. There's got to be something more to it. There's got to be something more that motivates you, because after a certain point that doesn't motivate you anymore. And that's why you see guys like Elon Musk and Bezos and Zuckerberg still, have all the money in the world. They're still in the game, still pushing it to the limit. And so at a much humbler, smaller scale, that's kind of where I'm at. And I think what makes sense to me is I read a book by an author named Donald Miller, and it's called 1,000 Miles in a Million Years. And what this book is about is he talks about living an interesting life. And he says to live an interesting life, with what few years we have, you have to have an interesting story. You have to have an interesting storyline to your life. And to do that, you have to do interesting things. And for me, I'm reading this book and I'm like, man, that makes a lot of sense to me, because my business is always the thing that causes me to do interesting things. I'm actually a pretty complacent, lazy type of guy. I don't really want to do any of this stuff, but the business is this like forcing function that causes me to take on challenges, causes me to learn new things, causes me to figure out solutions to problems. And so the business and the journey of that is kind of the storyline to my life. And it's causing my life to be interesting. And maybe one day if I ever wanted it, my lifetime to be a story that's worth telling, that the business is the storyline. And so that's, in a weird way, what keeps me going with one level to the next, is keeping my life interesting and giving like an answer to the question, why get out of bed this morning? And if I didn't, why does it matter? And the business is the answer to that question. It's like, okay, if I didn't like come into the office and do what I'm supposed to do today, there's 32,000 contractors that rely on the GreenPal platform to make a living. And I take that very seriously. And so it really does lend purpose to my life. And it lends like a set of challenges that in a weird way makes it fun. Now, I'm not going to lie, in the last 10 years, there's been many, many, many challenging parts of it. And there's been many, many grueling days, but it's been worth it. And it's what's made my life interesting and giving my life an interesting storyline.
Well, that you care for the folks on your platform, I think is a testament to the work that you're doing. Brian, I think we could keep chatting for a while, but what I'd like to suggest is when you get to 500,000, we chat again.
Let's do it.
And see how your role has progressed and how your new hires have gone. I wish you all the best to get to your million. And thank you so much for spending time with us today. I've learned quite a lot and quite inspired by your story.
Awesome, Nick. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with